jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find. Just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning, and welcome to Crossroads. Crossroads is heard around the world on WPFW 89.3. We want to thank all our folk or listeners who've been calling us and emailing from around the world who's been listening to Crossroads. We've been on air for 17 years, and in that 17 years, we missed 4 days, Martine and I. So it's a pleasure to bring you Crossroads on a weekly basis. As usual, we open up with what we call the grapevine, information that you can use, the grapevine. Hey, as California limits water use, people in prison face punishment for showering. Incarcerated Californians are bearing the brunt of the climate crisis and the state's water restrictions. As drought and extreme heat and other climate disasters increasingly plague California, people throughout the state have been subject to water restrictions. For many Californians, this means emergency watering. But what group of people has been forced to bear the brunt of the state's water restrictions? Those in prison. Incarcerated Californians have been forced for years to heavily limit their water use, including through restricted shower access, limited toilet flushing, and other extreme measures that people living outside prison walls would never be expected to endure. Although 80% of California's developed water goes to agriculture, they responded to the emergency by creating a water conservation plan. The department issued an order limiting the number of showers for incarcerated individuals to 3 per week, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturdays. Many showers were equipped with shutoff valves controlled by officers who would turn them off after 5 minutes, regardless of the weather or the activities a person had done that day. Only those with certain jobs, such as those who worked in the prison's kitchen, construction, and maintenance departments, were allowed to shower daily. Throughout California prisons, outdoor showers were condemned. Water hoses in kitchen areas discontinued as garbage disposal uses ceased. Numerous drinking fountains were turned off. Ice machines access was limited to the minimal amount needed to comply with the heat plan for at-risk prisoners. Showers in prison are often offered after breakfast, a time that conflicts with going to the yard to exercise, leaving people forced to choose between one or the other. If you miss the shower window and try to take one later in the day, an officer will likely issue a rules violation report, which can impact a parole hearing for people serving life sentences. One incarcerated person who actually remained anonymous due to fear of reprisals from members of the Board of Parole hearing said that he was denied his parole date for 3 years and instructed to enroll in a criminal thinking class for taking a shower at the wrong time. Boy, that's rough. Starve and Charge. Aramark cuts free prison meals to boost profits, the new suit claims. A lawsuit claims that prison food company is cutting institutional meals to force incarcerated people to purchase and buy costly food items from the same vendor at the prison commissary store. Food is uniquely powerful too, and Aramark is using it to explore the captive consumer market of incarcerated people and their families to unlawfully profit off of them. The lawsuit alleges that this scheme unfairly targets incarcerated people in a bid to drive profits for Aramark, which generated $18.5 billion in fiscal 2025. Aramark has exclusive control over all food in West Virginia's correctional facilities and is the largest food service provider for prisons and jails in the United States. As of December 1, Aramark portfolio includes 16 State Department of Corrections. Last year, the company reported serving approximately 450 correctional facilities. The new legal challenge is based on consumer protection laws intended to prevent unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices. At the federal level, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which I believe was abolished by President Trump, has traditionally been tasked with enforcing these laws, while states also have their own consumer protection statute. The lawsuit alleges that Aramark is in violation of the West Virginia Consumer Credit and Protection Act because it is unfair to people who, because of their incarceration, limits what they can buy and where they can buy it from and have no other less exploitative options to feed themselves. The goal here really is just to require the companies follow the same laws with respect to incarcerated people that they have to follow with everybody else, that they're not allowed to exploit people because they're incarcerated. And boy, that is some stuff. ICE threw thousands of kids in detention, many for longer than court-prescribed limits. Former immigration staffers argue ICE is choosing to detain families for a prolonged period to speed deportation and compel them to leave. A mother and her five-year-old daughter went to a Chicago laundromat this fall, expecting it to be a regular day. But as they were washing their clothes, the mother said they were surrounded by 20 armed officers in full riot gear and arrested. The mother, identified in court documents, had been living in the United States for almost 2 years. She said the officers detained her with her daughter at a Chicago airport where they had no access to showers, phones, or the ability to brush their teeth. The food they gave us was not edible, the mother said in court documents. We didn't eat anything for days. They didn't even give us water to drink. After about 2 days, they were transferred to the Dilley Immigration Processing Center in Dilley, Texas, which she described as a living hell. Sometimes my daughter doesn't want to leave our room because she is so sad and just wants to leave this prison so badly. She cries and cries. An analysis by the Marshall Project of Immigration and Customs Enforcement data obtained by the Deportation Data Project found that the Trump administration's revival of family detention has swept thousands of children into ICE custody. At least 3,800 children under age 18, including 20 infants, have been booked since Trump started his deportation move. ICE data reveals what happened to 1,600 people arrested during Chicago Blitz. Most of those arrested were swiftly shuttled to a sprawling array of detention centers in 13 states, many with the reports of troubling conditions. When federal agents launched Operation Midway Blitz in September, they arrested thousands of people, at times near schools or child care centers, and used chemical agents like tear gas on protesters. In response to the often chaotic and high-profile raids, city residents blew whistles to alert neighbors of approaching agents and organized magic school buses to accompany children to school. The Marshall Project analyzed ICE data that includes arrests and detentions through the middle of October. The most current detailed records publicly available, people who ICE arrested during that time were later detained in 13 states at county jails, privately run detention centers, and a rapidly constructed facility on a military base, as the figures show. And that's been what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. And thank you for tuning in. Our topic this morning is CSOCIA's role in the community. CSOCIA stands for Court Services Offender Supervision Agency. It's a federal agency that was implemented when they shut down Morton and it came with the Revitalization Act. And the D.C. Revitalization Act transferred all authority supervision for parole, probation, supervised release for courts, housing, location, placement, etc. That's just a few of the things that courts CSOCIA does. And joining us is a man I should have had on the show years ago. His name is Cedric Hendricks. He's the Associate Director of Court Services and Offender Supervision. Cedric and I go back into the 80s, and this man has a history in this community that very few people are aware of or knowledgeable about. He's been working with CSOCIA and criminal justice issue, but I met him in the 80s, and we did a film that was that he was responsible for getting the funding for and shaking the bushes to make sure the powers that be back in the day would give black people more equitable access to producing television shows and videos and et cetera. And I just want to say good morning to you, Cedric Hendricks. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm delighted to be here on Crossroads with you, Roach, my old friend. And thank you for that look back at our history together. You know, there was a lot of hard work we did, struggling to try and get these local TV stations to improve their hiring and their programming. And we, I have to say, enjoyed some success. And the program that you produced with your partner, Larry Bryant, was an award-winning program, and we were able to prove through your achievement that African-American producers could deliver the goods. So congratulations to you. After all these years, I look back proudly at that history.
I want to thank you, Seth, for doing it, because the film we did with Larry Bryant, we had Peaches and Herb as the focal point of it, and the film won an international award. We went to Venice, Italy to receive the award. Of course, I wasn't able to go. I was on parole, and they wouldn't allow me to travel out of the country during that time. But still, because of your efforts and other folks that you worked with, you made the TV industry in Washington, D.C. stand up, take a look, and invest in upcoming progressive new TV producers. And I want to thank you, Seth, for what you did to get us this award, an international award. Man, you've been doing so much stuff. A lot of folks are not aware of your history in music and TV and film.
Well, you know, let me just mention, you know, I used to have a show on WPFW.
You did?
Back in 1978, when I first came to town, I met with Lauren Cress Love, who yes. at the time was the public affairs director. And through collaborating with her, I was able to begin producing a show called For My People.
Yeah.
It was a public affairs news magazine that came on biweekly. It was on until 1983. So for 5 years, we did a show. And my show was like a public affairs magazine, like Time or Newsweek, where you got a section on business, you got a section on healthcare, you got a section on science and technology. And I had different people that I recruited from the community to produce those segments of the show. So it was called For My People, which is the name of a poem by Margaret Walker. Mm-hmm. For My People.
I remember that. There. Yes.
So yeah. That's another important. And in fact, and you mentioned my work with music. I have to say that the programming director at WPFW, Miss Katia Stitt, was the person who helped introduce me to jazz. And I recall it back in 1985 when I was working for Congressman Conyers, and he said, "Well, we're going to do a workshop on jazz at the Black Caucus." And I'm from Detroit, where
I remember that.
Motown was the soundtrack of my youth, and. Yeah. And Katia was someone who would sometimes come through the congressman's office. And so I began working with her, and she connected me with everybody.
Yeah.
And we did the first Black Caucus jazz forum and concert in 1985. The performance was by Buck Hill.
Yeah.
Washington's legendary Buck Hill, who's, of course, his mural is up on 14th and U. But that went on for 33 years. Hmm. Every year at the Black Caucus, me and a partner of mine named Bill Brower produced a jazz concert. And we had, you know, world-renowned artists, but also we always tried to feature local artists in those concerts. So that's just kind of part of who I've been. But as you point out, we're here today to talk about my current life at CSOSA.
You know, and that's amazing. The little tidbits we're talking about what you were doing in the 70s and the 80s, and you were dealing with TV, radio, films, movies, music. How did you transition from all of that over to court services and defender supervision? Court, and explain what CSOSA court service is. And what
well, yeah, let me say that, as I mentioned, I'm from Detroit, and my first job in the field of criminal justice was with the Michigan Department of Corrections, where I served as a halfway house counselor. And that was back in the, the 70s.
You ain't got to say it.
But then when I came to D.C., I came to work at the United States Probation Office at the district court here.
Yeah.
And so I worked there until 1980, and then I quit and went to law school at Howard University. And so I was very pleased to have a great experience there at the Howard University School of Law. And then when I came out of there, that's when I went to work on the Hill for Congressman John Conyers, who was my hometown congressman, but also chaired the House Subcommittee on Criminal Justice. So I was able to move from, you know, kind of the front line of working in the criminal justice system to working on law and policy within the field of criminal justice. And so, you know, among the issues I worked on for him was capital punishment, hate crimes. And we all know Congressman Conyers' record as a civil rights advocate, a person who advocated for fairness in the justice system and fought for it, fought against police misconduct and all such things. So I worked for him for a long time. And I think as I was leaving his office, last thing I worked on was his reparations bill. So I know your co-host in Kichi Taifa has strong ties to that. But I remember knowing her back in that time frame. So I've been around. I've done a lot. But as you said, now I'm at CSOSA, where, in fact, I've been for about 25 years.
Wow. You know, it's amazing, man, that to have somebody on the show. I've been on over 40, 50 years, and you've been consistent. You've been on point. You've been on right there. I mean, you've always been working on issues designed to uplift, improve our community, members in our community. And again, I ought to kick myself in the butt for not having you on years ago, Sid. I see you almost every month at some events, some activities. You were there on the front line, and every time I see this rascal, he got a big fat smile on his face and a sandwich. Boy, every time I see you, he got a big fat smile and a sandwich.
Well, you know, and I have to say that you know, our relationship over the years has been one of pride and pleasure for me, Roach, and so I want to thank you for again what we've been able to accomplish together, and I also have to give a nod to Mertine.
Yes.
Because Mertine has done some work with my daughter Nikki
in the
fashion arena, and they were down at Macy's in the fashion incubator, and that was a great accomplishment of theirs to get into that. And
yes.
And so you know, we're tied together in a lot of ways, and it's through accomplishment, and that's what I'm so very proud of.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that, Sam, because a lot of folks have been calling me and saying, what is CSOSA? There's no more D.C. border parole. They don't realize that the National Capital Revitalization and Self-Government Improvement Act abolished D.C. border parole, closed down Lorton. Our inmates or prisoners were sent to the federal system, to federal institutions, even though they had D.C. charges, and they came on the federal guidelines. And when the guy said they got a parole officer, there's no more parole officers in D.C. They're called something else.
Call them community supervision officers.
Community supervision officers. You know what that reminds me of? Said I was in Lorton for 10 years, and it was called Lorton Reformatory. I woke up one morning and looked at the gate, and they changed the name to Lorton Correctional Complex. Mm-hmm. So I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what's the difference between a reformatory and a correction complex, and ain't nothing changed on the inside, just the names. So every few years, the names change. There's no more parole officers in D.C. They're community supervision officers, but they function as parole officers. What's different from them as parole officers under CSOSA as opposed to parole officers under D.C. border parole?
Well, I think the important thing to emphasize is the community that comes first in that title. If you ever take a look at the seal of CSOSA, there's a banner over the Capitol Dome in the seal that says community, accountability, and justice. So for us, community is always first, you see. And you may remember, Roach, the brother that was the interim director when I first came to CSOSA in 2001 was Jasper Ormond.
I remember Jasper.
Yes. You know, and Jasper had come from, as you know, the district government where he had worked on the beginnings of the CTF and all such things. But, you know, his point was that the folks that we have under supervision come from the community. And when they leave us, they are back in the community. I mean, they're always in the community. And so his challenge to us was to build partnerships, working relationships with the what he called the natural systems in the community that could bring resources and services to support our engagement with the men and women under supervision. So those folk who need housing, healthcare, education, and employment, our charge was to go find those in the community and bring them to bear to meet the needs of the men and women that we have under supervision. And what we realized was, to the extent that we're able to successfully meet those needs, people are much more stable and much more likely to successfully complete supervision. So for us, community is preeminent. It's where our work begins. It's where our partnerships are built. And it's where the supports and services that can benefit the men and women that we supervise are found.
You know, one of the things that come to question that folks, we get this question thrown at us constantly, said, our folk are sent from D.C. Whatever crime you commit, regardless whether state or federal, you're sent to a federal correctional facility. And when you're released, you have to report to CSOCIA for housing, employment, supervision, et cetera. How does that impact in D.C.? The D.C. Board of Parole, which was abolished due to the National Capital Revitalization Act.
Well, the Revitalization Act, as you correctly point out, took probation from the court. You remember back when Eugene Hamilton was the chief judge at the time of the Revitalization Act, there was a division of the court that did adult probation and juvenile probation. So the Revitalization Act pulled the adult probation service out of Superior Court. And as you point out, the Revitalization Act also abolished parole and pulled that. And so those two pieces, parole and probation, were put together to create CSOSA. And so, you know, part of, as you know, the story behind the Revitalization Act was that the district was experiencing a financial crisis. And during the Clinton administration, that administration's effort to help address that was to take the cost of those governmental functions off of the district and have the federal government assume those. Mm-hmm. And so that's how CSOSA was born. And you may remember someone who worked on my team for a long time was Margaret Quick.
Yes, and we went to her funeral together.
Yes, sir. And Margaret had been the last director of the D.C. Board of Parole. Yes. So when CSOSA was created, we took all of the officers that were in probation and parole and many of the management leaders like Margaret and brought them in to see CSOSA, so that transition, I think, was a smooth one, because it basically incorporated the same men and women who were doing the work into this federal agency, which again shifted the cost off of the district onto the federal government. So that's how the agency was born back in the Revitalization Act, which passed in 1997, I believe.
Let me throw this at you. Since parole has been abolished and now it's called supervised release, what's the difference between the old parole on the D.C. Board of Parole and CSOCIA's supervised release? Because we get folks calling us that they mad with the counselor or the supervisor agent for this reason, that reason. I had one guy said, who did 50 years. I ain't gonna call his name because he's kind of, I ain't gonna call his name. He did 50. He never had a job in his life. He's 72 years old and he went down to see his supervisor. And they asked him, what was his plans for employment? He never had a job in his life. He's 72 years old. I know you get more cases like that. What do you do with a situation like that? What do you tell the person in charge how to deal with these kind of situations? Because you had a lot of men and women did 30, 40, 50 years coming out, and they throw right in and see social. So what do you do with them?
Well, you know, we strive to provide a wide range of services and supports to the people under supervision, you know, from young to old. Now, I have to say that, you know, for someone who's 70 years old and obviously into retirement age, you know, the kind of work that they do. I mean, obviously need to have some means of support. We all have to have some means of support. And so we have to look to what's most appropriate for a person who may not have the work skills, who may not have the physical capability to do certain kind of work. But there are other kinds of supports out there. So, you know, we have a fairly robust effort to try and find employment for our folks. What we have always seen, my experience has been that half of the folks that come to us for supervision are unemployed. And so, you know, we work hard to try and find employment, appropriate employment for them. You know, we have a challenge of sorts in this labor market because many employers here just say no, you know, to anyone who has a history. And what we have done over the years is try and work to educate the employer community about second chance employment opportunities. You know, right now there is an organization called the Second Chance Hiring Alliance that is kind of under the umbrella of the Council for Court Excellence. We're a core group member of that. There's a brother, a returning citizen named Gene Downing, who is the facilitator of the Second Chance Hiring Alliance. And what we're endeavoring to do through that vehicle is engage employers and talk to them about second chance hiring, to give people a look not based on their history, but on the skills that they put on the table that can meet the talent needs that an employer has. You know, we have all kinds of folk under supervision with wide ranging skills. And for us, the challenge is, you know, matching up people with the right opportunities. And we have had some success at that. I have to point out that Tony Lewis Jr. is our vocational coordinator. And he has been working with me on my team for a number of years. You also probably know Edie Whittington.
I know. Everybody you call, we know.
who is on my team as well. She is our restorative justice facilitator. And she, too, works to help connect people with employment opportunities. So it's not easy because, again, you got many employers in this town that just say no. But, you know, we're struggling with them to get them to understand that, you know, people have the skills that can meet your talent needs. Just give them a chance to prove it, to demonstrate what they can do.
There you go.
And we
there
have some success in getting people employment. So, you know, I have to say, proudly, I guess, that the district government itself has been one of the leading employers of formerly justice involved individuals. You know, the Project Empowerment Program was a gateway to opportunity in the district government for many. And Project Empowerment continues today. The city has the Pathways Program that the Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement operates. We work with that. So we're, you know, referring our people under supervision to both Project Empowerment at the Pathways, as well as engaging and building relationships with employers who are open to hiring our folk. I have to say that we have, over the last year, been working closely with the Federal City Council, which has a very aggressive effort underway to try and connect people with construction-related jobs. And we have had some success in getting people into that industry. And in fact, we have worked with some of the hospitality industry partners within the Federal City Council, and we have had some success getting people employment within the hospitality industry in this town. Finally, let me just say that we have a partnership with the D.C. Department of Employment Services. It kind of goes beyond Project Empowerment. You know, they have job fairs frequently, and we're always funneling people into those. So we're doing all we can in that regard. Now, I also want to kind of talk about housing, because I know that's something that you and I have shared interest in. So I'll stop now and turn it back over to you for your next question.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, housing, like you say, is so major, a huge issue. But before even housing, are you able to employ most people who need work?
Well, you know, even at CSOSA, we had a program under our last director that was called the Credible Messenger Program, where we hired people with histories. It was a 6-month term position, but over the years we had, six cohorts of folks that we hired and went on from the work at CSOSA, to jobs in the district government and entrepreneurship and other places. So we, we're trying to be an example of what we were asking other employers to do. And so that struggle continues. Because people need to have some ability to support themselves. And again, yes. And we have them within our caseloads. Now, training is another line that we focus a lot of work on. For example, one of our partners is DC Central Kitchen, which, as you know, has a fabulous culinary arts training program. And over all the years I've been at CSOSA, we have worked very closely with them. Every class that they graduate has somebody from CSOSA in that class.
Right.
You see, and so those folks go forward into the hospitality industry. The AFL-CIO for many a year had a program called Building Futures, which was a construction or building trades training program. And we had many people go through that and find employment. You know, I have pictures when they were building the buildings down on the wharf, on the waterfront down there. You know, we had people who went through Building Futures and got employment with some of the construction companies and would send us pictures of themselves up there putting those buildings up. So it's, I have to say, a never ending struggle for us, but it's an important one. And so employment and training to enhance a person's employability are what we spend a lot of time on and for which we have a team of people who are dedicated to that effort.
You talked, mentioned a lot of different programs. And one of the things, again, said that we get up here at the station, a lot of folks or quite a few people coming out after 30, 40, 50 years and they're dying. And some guys died. In fact, we got a call last month of a man dying up in Leavenworth and they wanted the family back. What is the policy or the practice or what can CSOSA do for those folk who lose a loved one, who die in prison, don't have insurance, cannot afford to have the body shipped back from that particular state to D.C. and or the funeral? And I know D.C. gives up like $200-$300 for to contribute to the burial of a homeless or injured in person. What is the policy or practice or what is your experience with this set in terms of what can you share with our listeners if someone's loved one die in prison or die after a few months in the street? What can be done or what can CSOSA do or who can they go to get relief?
Roach, that's providing relief in that regard is really beyond the reach of CSOSA, but what it can be addressed by is through the partners that we have in this community. You know, you may remember that many years ago we started building our faith-based initiative, our faith community partnership. And there are many faith-based institutions that are still working with us to provide support and assistance and will reach beyond those in their congregation to help. There are some nonprofit organizations that also, I think, have that reach. You know, we all know about Paula Thompson's organization, which was
Second Chances.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's Courtney Stewart's organization, National Reentry Network for Returning Citizens. So, you know, we have to look toward our community partners who have the heart to serve and help and connect them with the need. And again, you know, faith institutions are in some cases well-resourced and also have ministries that are focused on prison. You know, you used to hear that term prison ministry.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of churches used to do that. And there are some still out here doing that work, doing it not just with us, but doing it on their own. And so I think it becomes important to, when we find a case like that, you know, hit that Reentry Action Network listserv, which is, I think, a wonderful place to find supports for families or just as involved individuals in need. Now, you know, the Reentry Action Network is comprised of partners like CSOSA, the Public Defender Service, you know, the Voices for a Second Chance, and many, many, many more organizations. And that listserv, you know, is a vehicle for, you know, it's like call and response. Hey, yes. I need help with this for that person. And, you know, you can see it coming back. So this community is, I think, blessed to have
an abundance of service. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, and I have to say, I haven't mentioned it yet, but MORCA, the Mayor's Office on Returning Citizens Affairs, you know something about that. You know, we've had mayors in this city over the years that have been focused on trying to you know, bring the city's resources to bear in a helpful manner with justice involved individuals. And MORCA now has a new leader.
Yes.
Brother Tlaib Shakur, who I'm going to be meeting with shortly. But that organization is also and the Ready Center that the Department of Corrections has.
Yes.
You know, it's another place where resources are congregating and are available to be tapped to help meet needs. We may not be able through these networks to meet every need, but the important thing is that we're all part of these communities of service, if you will, and weigh in to try and help those who need help.
You know, this is go ahead.
This is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. We're speaking with Cedric Hendricks, Associate Director, Court Services and Offender Supervision. The drive is over, but you can still donate. You can always go to Dollar WPFW, donate always to the Crossroads Roach Brown Nkechi Taifa Show.
Well, Nkechi is not with us today. She's been traveling, said she wanted to be here. One of the things that with this new legislation that's being kicked around in Congress is laws all over the country designed to restrict, punish, and criminalize our youth. And because we don't have Lawton, the law is that's coming down that most youth now who get locked up can be tried as adults if you're at a certain age. The federal government or the federal bureau of prison does not have a youth facility. So for these youth who get locked up at 14, 15, or 16 and get tried as an adult, where do these youth go and what kind of services are available for these youth since there's no facility for juveniles who've been sentenced as adults? What's C-Social's position on that?
Well, Roche, you know, we're the community supervision people. We're not the incarceration people. Yeah. So our reach doesn't go down that lane. I understand the challenge that you're talking about. I was in a meeting, a Criminal Justice Coordinating Council meeting recently, where there was a report given about the need that our juvenile justice involved population has for behavioral health care. And how we have youngsters who are sent out of state to obtain those kinds of psychiatric or behavioral services because they aren't provided here in the district. So these are questions that, you know, people are talking about and trying to find solutions to. But I understand your question. That's just not something that CSOSA does. We're the community supervision and not the incarceration.
So another, I guess, let me phrase it, work it another way. For those youth who's been locked up as juveniles and taken to court as and sentenced as adults, do you get any of them guys and
where
are you coming at? And so what kind of special services are there in a special service for them juveniles who've been locked up as juveniles and sentenced to adult sentences?
Oh, yes. So they when they do come into the community, they are under our supervision. And we've had youth programming for many a year. I mean, right now we are running a young adult program at the Reentry and Sanction Center, the place we have over there on the D.C. General Campus with, you know, services and supports that are particularly targeted to the young adult population. Yeah. You know, for us, you know, it's kind of there's those that you talk about, the Title 16 cases, but the 18 to 24 are in that young adult range, and for which we are endeavoring and have over the years provided targeted special programming for.
I'm sure some of our audience would like to ask you a question. So I'm going to open up the lines, 202-588-0893. If you have a question for Cedric Hendricks or Roach, please call us at 202-588-0893.
It said, since it's been 20 years since the D.C. Revival, the National Capital Revitalization Act took over, all most of the corrections and judiciary functions in D.C., I forgot what I was going to ask. The bottom line is, have you seen a difference? What's the difference between CSOCIA taking over probation, parole, and supervised release as it used to be? Are you seeing a difference? Is it better under CSOCIA, or was things the same under the old D.C. Board of Parole?
Well, I think that the difference that CSOCIA was able to make in the earliest was that it was arguably better resourced than the district agencies. Because as I mentioned before, you know, back in 1997, when Sharon Pratt Kelly was the mayor, there was a financial crisis. You remember that there was a control board that the Congress put in place to manage the district's governmental affairs for a number of years. And then I guess after Tony Williams became mayor, there was stabilization with respect to the district's finances, and the control board went away. And so I guess you could say the infusion of federal resources was helpful in bringing some financial stability to the district. But you know, for us, I think, you know, the approach to the work is, and I can't speak because, you know, I wasn't involved in community corrections before I came to CSOCIA, but the focus on community engagement and partnerships is really our strong suit. And again, we've, I think, been fairly successful. You may remember, Ro, some of the events that we did over the years when we would do those recognition dinners. We used to do them at St. Luke Catholic Church, and then we gravitated over to Gallaudet, and we would have recognition dinners, and we would give awards to returning citizens who had done well under supervision. We would also recognize the mentors from the faith community that had worked with us, and we would give awards to the mentor of the year and the mentee of the year. So, you know, those kinds of programs were obviously expensive, important, because recognition, I think, is necessary when people are doing well and achieving things. We're not in a position to do that anymore. But I thought we, for many a year, you know, provided leadership and recognition to those who were doing well. And in fact, you know, we're able to bring some of those folk back into helping us with other folk that are, you know, currently under supervision. So, you know, we stay community focused, community engaged, building solid, reliable community partnerships that help us help the people, the men and women under supervision.
For folks listening to the show who want to get involved, who want to, because you mentioned a lot of information, gave up a lot of information to different programs. D.C. is pregnant with programs for returning citizens. And when you mentioned Marca, I started Marca, created Marca, and was the first director. And it took 5 years, Cedric, of going through holy hell with the city council and getting Myron Barrett to make sure that was a federal, that was an agency within the executive branch of the D.C. government. As a result of that now, 8 states have saw the need of having an office in the executive branch of the government to address the needs and issues of the incarcerated and the newly released. What do you see, said, that we can do, or the community can do, or anybody who's listening, if they want to get involved and take some of the information as you imparted this morning, what could they do? What would you like to, since you say the first thing is on is community, what can the community do to work with
Well, you know, Roach, one of the things that Marion Barry was also responsible for creating at the same time as MRCA was established was the Mayor's Commission on Reentry.
Yes.
Which is a body that still exists. Maybe there aren't a lot of folk who are aware of it, but that is a community or based group, a commission that has returning citizens on it, has community people on it. And, you know, and that's kind of one vehicle. The other thing is to support organizations in the nonprofit realm that are out here doing the work.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned before Voices for a Second Chance. You know, they've been around. Shoot, they were around before CSOSA. Remember, it used to be called Visitor Service.
Ann Cunningham.
Right. But way back in the day. But they're still out here doing doing this hard work. I went to a program, an awards program that they had not long ago, because they had some, they have, they're training people to be advocates. They're training returning citizens to be advocates, not just for themselves, but for their community, if you will. And they had an awards program, I guess, about 5 weeks ago that I was at. So those kind of, that investment in development, skill development, connecting people with resources. I mean, there are groups like that that always need help and support. So RAND and all of these groups are members of the Reentry Action Network. Now, anybody out there should Google Reentry Action Network because, you know, they periodically do a newsletter. They have public meetings periodically. And again, the various organizations that are a part of RAND are all in the business of trying to provide resources and services and supports to justice involved or formerly justice involved individuals. Most of them are nonprofit, if not all, and they can all benefit from volunteerism and contribution.
And back the big issue, housing. Where do we go from here?
Yeah, now one of the things that CSOSA has done over the years is provide supportive housing. You know, right now we have, I think, about 90 beds through a portfolio of contracts that we have with supportive housing vendors. We've got three contracts in place for supportive housing services. We've got another couple of contracts in place for residential treatment that are important. We also have a contract with an outpatient treatment vendor as well. So we're trying to address that need, but we can't meet it all. You know, so, you know, there are organizations that contact us all the time and say, hey, I've got a facility. Come over and check it out. And people are not just wanting to do work, but there are people who are doing that work right now, using their own resources to provide supportive housing to justice-involved individuals. So they're out there. And when we go into the market, you know, we have to do, because we're, you know, the government, we have to do a solicitation, have a competitive solicitation process.
I know.
You know, but the important thing is, but we do it. And we, as I said, we got three supportive contracts in place right now.
Yeah.
And what is that? You said three supportive contracts.
We have contracts with three different supportive housing providers in place today.
You know, Cedric, we've been meeting at a church on 15th and P called St. Luke's, a group called Optimistic Gentlemen and Ladies. This is a group comprised of men and women who've done decades in prison. In fact, it's six of us. And would you believe all six now are in the hospital, coming out of the hospital in a nursing home or whatever. But these gentlemen and ladies are trying their darnest to see what they can do. And we got people that need emergency housing. They might be off of supervision in the street. They don't have nowhere to go. They don't have a supervising agent to go to report to. And they're just wandering through the streets. Is there any emergency housing for these seniors who are in their 70s and 80s, who are off of supervision, don't have no place to go? We don't, and all they can contact is CSOSA or Department of Human Resources. Is there anything available for this population?
Well, you know, I got an email this morning from a guy who is a provider of supportive housing to justice-involved individuals. Mm-hmm. And he was reaching out because he's interested in doing business with us when the next opportunity to compete for an award occurs. But he's got folks in beds right now. Now, what I'll do, Roach, is when we finish the show, I don't want to put him out on blast now, but I'll send you his information. And there are some other folks that we met with. You know, when folks call us and say, hey, you know, we're trying to do that, we go out and see what's out there because, we want to know what's real and what's make-believe. Right. You know, and the good thing is that there are folks in this community who have a commitment to providing supportive housing, are marshaling their own resources to try and do it. And I have to say that the city in past years has put money into supportive housing as well. Through the Office of Victim Services and Justice Grants.
Yes.
The city is, but you know, the government can't do it all. And it's good that the private sector, nonprofit sector is out here too. But the important thing is to know all of what's out there so that if somebody can't find a bed over here, you can steer them to where there might be a bed over there.
Beautiful.
So you know that, we network on that all the time. So we're just two souls committed to meeting the needs of those who have needs, and we'll put our heads together and figure it out.
I'm glad you're on, Seth. You gave up a lot of information and a lot of folks, man, that didn't know all this. You called almost most agencies or organizations who are working in the trenches, man, to make this thing a little better. What do you see, Seth? What need to be done from your point of view? What are the top two items or top two issues that we need to address?
I have to say housing, healthcare, education and employment are really the top four needs. And I could add to that family reunification. Because people need a support system. And in fact, that's what was behind the formation of our mentoring program, our faith-based mentoring program, because we were seeing people come home, you know, who were estranged from their families, you know, and so the important thing was to find, not that we were trying to find them a church family to plug them into, but there were people in these faith institutions that had a heart to serve.
Yes.
And many of these churches had resources to bring to bear. So that is a critical need as well. People need a support system. And if it's not your family, then you need to find it, like NARC. Has support groups, you know, that Wednesday support group thing they do that's online. So, you know, you can find it in the group you just mentioned over at St. Luke on 15th and P, you know, where it's a coming together of folk with a common experience to share information about need and services and supports and connect people to what they need. You know, I'm familiar with that church. I visit that to worship from time to time. It's in my neighborhood. I might want to come by. We'll talk offline about maybe I can stop by and
we'll be glad to have you. In fact, Inner Voices performed at church twice in 73.
Okay.
And here we go. 40 years later, we come back to the church as a basis to begin to start another little program. Our time is up, Sid, and I'm glad we had you on. You gave up a lot of information. You want to leave our listeners with some closing information, how to contact you, Sid, Cedric Hendricks?
Well, yeah, I'm at CSOL, so you can hit me at Cedric, which is CEDRIC.Hendricks, HENDRICKS, at CSOSA.gov. Looking forward to hearing from anyone out there who has a question or wants to partner with us to help meet the needs of the men and women that are under supervision. You know, if you've got some housing, you know, if you've got a pathway to health care, education or training is always a thing that people need so they can, you know, build up their employability. We want to talk to you, so please reach out. So if I can repeat it again, Cedric.Hendricks at CSOSA.gov.
Thank you. Okay. Our guest has been Cedric Hendricks, Associate Director of Court Services and Defender Supervision, and a personal friend of mine for over 45 years. I want to thank you, Sid, and we will have you back. And boy, you are a wealth of information.
Yes.
Thank you, and we'll see you next week. And remember, your inner voice is never wrong. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
It really is Merry Christmas.
I'm on the right one there.
Another day has come and gone in a world where I don't belong. Another week has passed me by. It's not because I didn't try. Nobody saw me walking. Before they notice me, another job that I just can't get, a nice apartment the landlord just won't rent. I go to bed but my sleep just won't come. My belly's empty and my brain is numb. Nobody saw me walking, and nobody heard me talking. Seems like I gotta do wrong before they notice me. Seems like I gotta do wrong before they notice me. Just won't come. My belly's empty and my brain is numb. Nobody saw me walking, and nobody heard me talking. Seems like I gotta do wrong before they notice me. Yes, I do. Before they notice me.
On Monday, January 19th, 9 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents Injustice Anywhere, honoring the Pan-Africanist MLK and Haiti, the first sovereign Black Republic. From 9 a.m. until noon, we examine the Pan-Africanist legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. From noon until midnight, we center Haiti, her history, triumphs, troubles, and culture. That's Injustice Anywhere, honoring the Pan-Africanist MLK and Haiti, the first sovereign Black Republic. Monday, January 19th, 9 a.m. until midnight. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Thank you doesn't seem to be adequate. Your support is critical. Thank you, thank you, thank you again. We appreciate you partnering with WPFW and helping to make our end-of-year drive a success. If you would still like to support WPFW, make us stronger, it is never too late. Go to our website at wpfwfm.org. Thank you for considering WPFW in this season of giving. Wishing you and yours joy, love, and peace.
Greetings and happy holidays. The new year on WPFW will be celebrated in sonic bliss as some of your favorite programmers present the 2026 edition of New Year, New Jazz, our annual survey of the Jazz Year in Review 2025 on Thursday, January 1st from 5 a.m. until midnight. This day will present a delightful and potent mix of favorite 2025 jazz record releases, honoring jazz ancestors who passed in 2025, and music representative of our favorite 2025 DMV live jazz performances. That's Thursday, January 1st, 2026, New Year, New Jazz on WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. Don't sleep.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.